Nora Rawlinson of Early Word. Welcome to First Flights, the Penguin debut author program, a unique opportunity for librarians to get to know the authors of major new titles coming out in the next few months. If you haven't already, you can join First Flights by signing up on earlyword.com. You'll receive advanced copies of forthcoming debut novels and have the opportunity to join a live online chat with each author. Today, Carrie Hudson, author of Tony Hogan, Bought Me an Ice Cream Float Before He Stole My Mom, coming from Penguin Press in January, joins us by phone from London. Welcome, Carrie.
Hello there. Hi, Nora. Happy to be here.
Well, great for you to join us. Of course, I have to start with the title of the book, Tony Hogan, Bought Me an Ice Cream Float Before He Stole My Ma, which to me is almost like a haiku of the whole novel. It gives you an indicator of what you're in for. There's going to be a maybe contentious relationship with a mother. She's going to have difficult relationships with men. There's going to be ups, there's going to be downs, and food is going to be involved. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Absolutely. I wish I could steal that from a copy, actually, my cover.
Tell me how the title came about.
It's been on quite a journey, that title, actually. So it began when I was writing it. My working title was The Council Estates Cookbook.
It was The Council Estates Cookbook. Okay.
The Estate Cookbook, exactly. And the idea was that the food is so central. So I was going to open each chapter with a short recipe for...
And let's talk about the food. You say that the food is so central, but it's not... organic, healthful food. It is more packaged comfort food. Is that fair?
Exactly. I mean, it's poor people's food, really. So food that is packaged is cheap. So we had a very funny editorial meeting where one of the ladies said, completely aghast, and all the food is white.
White in color, right?
Yeah, white. So it's all carbohydrates. It's
right.
All starchy. There's no greens
greens.
No fruit vegetables. So food is important, and it's partly because at the time Janie, the young protagonist, has no idea that the food is bad, but also that it reflects a sort of cultural sort of has a cultural significance in the way that lots of food does in societies.
Tell us about Janie. We first meet her as she's being born. She talks about being born, actually. Tell us about her.
So Janie is the protagonist. We take her from the moment she's born right the way through to her 16th birthday. And the book is really about that growing and that burgeoning of adulthood. And sort of the gentle loss of innocence that she has, or the sometimes not so gentle loss of innocence. And so the book follows her mum, Iris. She's a single parent, and eventually a younger sister who comes along called Tiny. As they travel down from Scotland through the UK, going to living in council estates and long stay bed and breakfast care homes, and finally ending up in a very sort of dilapidated, depressed seaside town called Great Yarmouth. And really the crux of the novel is, does Janie have enough fight and enough energy and enough about her to escape the same path that her mum has taken the family down?
And the reason that they keep moving from place to place?
It's partly, I think, that Iris always just thinks the next move will be better. Iris is habitually quite transient, so she has quite a big family up in Aberdeen, a big fisherman and fishwife family up in Aberdeen, but she's estranged from them, really. She's a black sheep, and so she's always moved around quite a lot. Iris is an eternal optimist. It doesn't matter how bad every decision turns out to be. She'll always think that the next place is better because there's a guy there, or there might be the possibility of some work. Or, I mean, often it's just that she's got no reason to stay where she is and no reason not to go, and so she decides to go.
And Janie is sort of the little hostage to this whole thing, having to move from place to place and readjust to each new situation.
Exactly. And so a lot of it, I think, is about Janie, often quite humorously, I think, quite wryly observing what's going on.
Right.
And then also adapting to it. Quite fascinating to see how, I think, she you know, she uses all that fight she has to adapt to each new situation. I think it makes her quite an unusual young woman by the time you get to the end of the book.
One of the places that she finds solace is in libraries. It made me wonder if the same had been true for you growing up.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I like Janie, spent so much of my childhood in teens in libraries. I also moved around a lot, and I came from a low-income family. I didn't have the greatest education by any means, and so libraries were absolutely my sanctuary. They were safe and they were free, which was a huge thing, and I was really lucky that I had often quite kind librarians who let me stay for a long time and who picked me special books. I really credit libraries and having access to free libraries to being one of the big reasons why I'm a writer today, really.
And I have the sense that you've been working to help support libraries who are going through tough times in the UK right now.
Yeah, I mean, I've signed a lot of petitions and things. I wish I was out of the country for a lot of last year in Vietnam, finishing my second book. So I was out for quite a lot of the big protests. But what's been really heartening, actually, is just how much people have gotten behind their local libraries. You know, things that buildings that people think people aren't really using anymore because it's all on the internet and you can buy secondhand books for £2 from Amazon. In fact, actually, when they were threatened by being taken away, whole communities got together and they had sit-ins and protests and, you know, they got the press involved. So, you know, it just shows how really vital and important libraries are to local communities, I think.
You mentioned that your education was somewhat spotty. What made you want to write a novel?
Yeah, my somewhat spotty education is a bit of an understatement. So I finished school without any qualifications and went back to college to take some, and finished by doing a diploma in performing arts, which is the worst idea if you ever want to have a job. But I think I wanted to write the novel just because when I was you know, working my way through every library book and every library that I ever visited, I never really found anything that really closely represented the world that I came from. Except Roddy Doyle and Frank McCourt were probably the closest, but they were men and it was an older sort of thing. And so I felt like that there was a gap there and that I wanted to address it. But I really never thought I was going to be published. So when I was writing Tony Hogan, I was really just writing it because I really, you know, I wanted to write that. I want to write about my background. I want to write about that world. I took huge joy in writing. I still do. And so I just, you know, it was on my bucket list, if you like, write a novel. And so I did. Yeah.
You write the book in the first person, and it reads like a memoir. I mean, these people are very real. And I know that it's based a lot on your own background. Why did you decide to write a novel rather than a memoir?
I think I decided to write a novel because so much of it is creative writing. It does very closely follow my own background in that I was born in 1980, like Janie, the protagonist was, I followed the same route down the country that she did with my own mum, who was a single parent, and my little sister, and we lived in the same council estate and care homes and things. So it did really closely follow my own life. But there's so many novelist tricks in there, you know, things that have been massively exaggerated, things that have been dampened right down, whole sections that you know just never happened in my life are in there. I think I want to write a novel because you have to be a really phenomenal writer, I think, and also have a really exceptional story to be able to be a really effective memoirist. Frank McCourt, I think, for instance, is a phenomenal writer, but for me, I think a novel was a way that I could still tell my story and tell it authentically, but still make it, you know, an interesting, exciting, and hopefully quite compelling read for the readers.
What was the process of being edited like?
It was an absolute joy, which I know people say, and actually it was really painful. But it was really good. I was very fortunate that I had an editor who, I think, very much understood that it was so much my background and very different from hers, that she let me take the lead a lot. So the first sort of editorial job I had was my editor sent me a very brief sort of bullet pointed list of the things that she felt weren't quite right, and then I went back to her with what I thought were solutions for those problems, and then she agreed and I implemented them. So I was really fortunate that she let me own the novel. It feels so much like my book, because although she gave me great advice, especially in identifying where I couldn't see places where things needed to be changed and needed to be made better, she let me come up with the solutions. And I think that's especially because it's quite a personal book, and because the background is so much mine that I was potentially, you know, the only person who could come up with those solutions. So I was very, very, very lucky, which is what I say all of the time about this first book. It's just a book full of luck.
So I read the British version of the book, and I'm really curious, do you know, will there be significant changes to make this more, let's say, understandable to American audience? There's so many references to various kinds of foods, which I can kind of get what they are, but they're not exactly the foods that we're used to. Will changes be made?
I've spoken to my editor at Penguin, Emily, who's wonderful, very briefly about this. And she doesn't feel that it needs to be adapted or Americanized. So I think she feels that essentially, you know, there is an understanding there. Even if you don't know exactly what something is, you can get the gist. And those are, you know, those are peppered throughout the text, but they're not the main crux of what's happening always. So it's going to stay pretty true to the original version, actually, which I'm really happy about, because it's such a British book in sort of atmosphere. I think it would be really hard to Americanize it and keep that.
Yeah, if Funyuns suddenly appeared in the book, it would feel wrong. We're really looking forward to the book's appearance when it comes out here in the U.S. in January, and we're looking forward to our online chat with you in August. So thanks so much for joining us, Carrie. And thanks to you out there for listening. If you're not a member of Penguin's First Flights program, you can sign up at earlyword.com. And please come back for a live chat with Carrie Hudson on Wednesday, August 28th from 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern.